morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland. The weather has been weird lately. In February and March, it felt as warm and dry as May. Students here at UNM were wearing shorts. Then this week, parts of northern New Mexico got a foot of snow. Sure, we love to complain about the wacky weather, but is there something more going on? Which of these weird weather patterns are just random, and which tell us something about how climate change is affecting the Southwest? What can we do to prepare for the effects of severe weather, like flooding and wildfire? Is there anything we can do about the effects of climate change on New Mexico? Today we have three experts who will help us figure it out a little bit. Our guests are environmental journalist Laura Paskus, who writes about climate change and related issues for New Mexico In Depth. Welcome back to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me today, Gwen.
We also have Sean Bennett, who is meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service here in Albuquerque. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
In a few minutes, we will hear from Rose Whitehair, a disaster response and recovery expert with High Watermark. She was previously director of the Navajo Nation Department of Emergency Management. But first, let me come back to you, Laura. You've been an environmental reporter for a long time, but you have decided to narrow your focus for this new project called At the Precipice, New Mexico's Changing Climate, at New Mexico In Depth, a nonprofit news site that I've also worked for. What made you decide to look specifically at climate change for this project?
So for the past decade and a half, I've been covering climate change kind of piecemeal for different media outlets, including KUNM and the Santa Fe Reporter. And looking at the data of what's been happening in New Mexico and talking to so many different scientists about what is already happening and what's predicted to happen, it felt to me as though New Mexicans were being underserved in terms of the media covering climate change. And so I worked with New Mexico In Depth to come up with this project where I could just for 1 year focus entirely on the issue of climate change to help New Mexicans understand what's happening, especially because there's a big disconnect between what's happening on the ground and kind of what we're talking about and what we're planning for. So it's my hope that this project will really help all of us in New Mexico understand the issues a little better.
Yeah, Laura, it just snowed, so climate change isn't real. We'll get into that in a minute. Sean, I know I just pushed your buttons. That climate assessment, a recent climate assessment that Laura forwarded to me and that we're going to put on the website, showed that warmer temperatures, drought, and attacks on trees from things like beetle infestations have led to increased wildfires in the Southwest. I want to know, is this a normal cycle of weather changes? It gets warmer, it gets drier, it gets cooler, it gets wetter. Or is what we are experiencing now part of climate change in action?
I think the short answer is yes, we have some effects already being felt because of the volatility in the weather pattern. It's hard to distinguish everyday weather from whether or not that's climate change. We have natural variability in our weather. And the climate, by the way, is the accumulated weather over a 30-year period. So it's a statistical average, say, of all the weather that occurred on this date is what you expect for the high and low and so forth. But the volatility, so when we have events that are like additional hurricanes or strengthening storms than we might not expect, they are thought to be part of changes that may be in part induced by human-induced climate change. It's hard to extract specifically that's the culprit because it is natural for us to have some snowstorms in the spring. And what is very odd, it seems, is it comes on the heels of a warm, dry stretch, and we had a month that was extremely dry. In fact, for our records, the driest month was the month of March was the driest ever in the record.
The driest month ever in New Mexico was this March.
Yes.
So I said earlier that February and March felt unusually warm. I was disoriented the whole time. Were they remarkably warm?
They were a few, like a degree or two over average warmer than the expected. But there's other reasons for this. It's not the current activity in the weather and driven by major factors and signals in the ocean, what we call El Nino. And there's a warm phase going on, and that's added to the warmth that we're feeling. But then there's also climate change overall, and that's another question. So to extract, well, which is the human-induced, which is natural, they all come in the same package, so it's hard to say specifically that was. When you asked the question about the trees and beetle infestation, there were beetle infestation before we had human-induced climate change. But when you change the overall average temperature of the habitat, then you change dynamics within the habitat. Now, that's not my scientific expertise, but it puts additional stresses on the trees. They go through periods of drought, so naturally they will dry out and be a fire threat anyway. Then you add, you change the habitat so that the beetles then have a better habitat and attack the trees. And so you have a perfect mix for better fire conditions. And so that's what was been happening.
Callers, we want to hear from you. We're talking about severe weather and climate change and the connection between the two. We want to know, what are you doing to prepare for the effects of climate change at your house, in your community? Call us now, 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866. Or toll-free, 877-899-5866. We'll also take your questions for our panelists. You can email us at callinshow@KUNM.org. Laura, when I think about climate change, I tell myself, well, I bought an Energy Star refrigerator, so I'm doing pretty well. I bought a fuel-efficient car, and I always take my KUNM tote bag to the co-op when I do my grocery shopping. So now I can just sit back and worry about everybody else's global warming with the smug satisfaction that I did all I could. Am I good here?
Well, you're doing pretty well.
I wasn't being serious.
I think the thing about climate change and thinking about it for New Mexico specifically, for our future as a sustainable state to live in and to have your business in, is we need to be that those individual actions are helpful. In part, they're helpful because they sort of train you to be thinking about something other than your own convenience, you know, to be thinking about how you fit into the community and the world as sort of like a good citizen watching out for other people. So those individual actions are important, but we need to be thinking about how to deal with increased carbon emissions from transportation and power plants. And we also need to be thinking about adapting to these changed conditions, because no matter what you think or believe about climate change, the record shows that the Southwest is warming at a you know, pretty rapid rate compared to what it maybe should be doing if there weren't humans putting all this carbon into the atmosphere. And so I think that we need to be thinking about broad policy level changes on a state, county, national level, and also be thinking about our individual communities in terms of where we live. Do we have lots of houses and communities and businesses right up against forests that are at increased risk for wildfire? Do we want to think about what that means for planning and zoning and, you know, deciding safe and smart places to live in the future? We need to be thinking about where do we get our water for things like irrigation as well as cities,
I want to ask you really quickly, just to kind of recap for us, if climate change progresses more quickly than we think, if we can kind of compress the time frame a little bit, you know, we're talking about what we can expect to see are more wildfires, more drought, and what else? What's it going to look like if things keep going like they're going, and maybe faster and worse?
I think one of the things to think about is our water systems and how right now all of our surface water systems are set up to depend on winter snowfall and spring snow melt, and we have big reservoirs that hold that water and deliver it to all of us who need it. But as a huge part of, you know, sort of a warming climate is those higher temperatures, we're going to see more and more evaporation from those reservoirs, and we may be seeing less spring snow melt. I just think we need to start thinking about our big systems in terms of how we deliver and store water.
Good point. I want to welcome to the show Rose Whitehair. Rose, you are a disaster response and recovery expert with High Watermark, a company here in Albuquerque, and you used to be the director of the Navajo Nation Department of Emergency Management. We are so happy to have you here.
Good morning. Yate bene.
So I want to ask you, we were talking earlier about a recent climate assessment that said Native communities and border communities are among the most vulnerable to climate change. And that's because it said that, you know, some of these communities are more tied to farming and crops and the land and cattle, things like that. And also that they are less, because they are, many of them have less resource, fewer resources, and they're less resilient. They have less money to spend to try and fix these big problems. Is that your observation?
Well, it's not only, it's a number of things. It's not just the issues that you listed, but also the fact that a large number of our tribal communities don't have a lot of the economic development that our surrounding border towns have. The other issue that I see is if you have a large group of people that have been placed into reserves and reservations, tribal lands, previously we used to be able to move with the land. Previously, our people used to be able to, when Mother Earth moved, we moved. We migrated with the buffalo, the fish. We have summer camps, fish camps, sheep camps, depending on what tribe you're with. So those are not available anymore. So if you have some coastal communities like Quinault Nation or our Alaska brothers and sisters that have been for millennia staying within their communities and know how to properly care for the earth and also know how to use what resources that they have, such as salmon or different types of subsistence that they have.
Let's take a call right now. We have Brian in Santa Fe. Welcome to the show, Brian, and good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you today.
So I understand you want to talk about beavers.
Yes. I am the regional director for Defenders of Wildlife, so part of my job is to talk about wildlife. And one of the easiest, most cost-effective and fun ways that we can adapt to rapidly changing climate and severe events is to reestablish our native beaver population. We have very effectively wiped out the majority of our beaver populations in the West, mostly because of trapping, but also because they can be a nuisance when they get into our human infrastructure, like our acequia systems and our ditches and all that sort of thing. But the great thing about beaver is when they are ecosystem engineers, and when we reestablish them in our mountains and in our streams, they can slow down water, and they can create the dams that will hold water for longer periods of time in the mountains and release it slowly so that we can have it when we need it through the growing season. So one of the things we're going to see with climate change in the severe weather is we're going to see more precipitation in the form of rain, and we'll probably see it earlier. We'll see snow melt earlier. So in other words, we're probably going to have more flooding, and we're probably going to see our snow melt coming off the mountains earlier in the season. What would happen if we were able to reestablish healthy beaver populations, especially in our mountains, is that they could hold the water in their dams much longer through the season so that it would be released when we needed it. Also, when they establish dams and they establish ponds and all the vegetation that goes with those systems, it slows down flood events. So when we get these extreme rainstorms in the summer, which are more likely with climate change, we'll see the beavers slowing that water down and preventing, flooding that could be disastrous to communities downstream.
Brian, thank you for that reminder to look at the native creatures in our environment and how they helped preserve for a long time natural patterns. We really appreciate that. We have to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about what New Mexico can do to prepare and adapt for the long-term effects of climate change on our water, our crops, our gardens, our forests, and our beavers. What do you think we should do to prepare for climate change? The number is 277-5866 here in New Mexico. In Albuquerque, that's 277-5866 or toll-free 877-899-5866. You can also post to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio, or tweet at KUNM News. We'll be right back.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting public radio KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated civil rights, criminal defense, wrongful death, security clearance, and Indian and family law cases throughout New Mexico. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support comes from the New Mexico Symphonic Chorus and Orchestra, presenting Handel's Israel in Egypt, Sunday, May 1st at 3 p.m. at First United Methodist Church downtown. Conducted by Roger Malone. Info at nmschorus.org.
On the next Making Contact, whether you're a paid home care provider or rely on personal assistance to meet your daily needs, or a family member caring for a loved one, the nature of these relationships depend on mutual respect and dignity.
Everybody needs to feel that they have their own self-respect. It makes me feel good to know that I'm helping someone have that.
Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland. We are talking with environmental reporter Laura Paskus, meteorologist Sean Bennett, and disaster response and recovery expert Rose Whitehair. On the phone right now, we have Rabbi Neil in Santa Fe. In Santa Fe, good morning and welcome to the show, Rabbi.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
So what do you want to contribute this morning?
Well, you asked the question about what can we do in our communities to prepare for climate change, and I think that's a really important question. It's very often people talk about what they can do as individuals, buying energy-saving appliances and things like that. But the real strength of the real power for change, I believe, is actually in communities, in forming alliances of people who can come together with a shared vision, and very often that's ignored. Especially the faith communities, from which I'm obviously a representative at Temple Beth Shalom up in Santa Fe. I'm also the president of the ILA, the Interfaith Leadership Alliance. And we come together and we engage in social justice issues so that we can, because we all understand that that there are certain things that we are called to do by our religious faiths, our different religious faiths. And since we all share the planet, since we are all commanded in our different ways to care for creation, I think one of the most important things that we can do right now is actually come together and bring the faith communities in and try to get them involved and try to get them to inspire their members to actually bring about change.
Is this something you talk about, climate change, is this something you talk about with your congregation, Rabbi?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was just the other day, I was speaking at the PRC hearings about PNM. I think it's really important for us in our faith communities to engage in the awareness of the changing planet and the changing climate. In the Jewish tradition, we believe that everything in creation sings out their praise to God. And so we have a duty to protect everything, to protect this sort of global choir. We talk about this in our community at Temple Beth Shalom. We talk about this in the Interfaith Leadership Alliance. It's a very important religious duty.
Are there things that you talk about, concrete steps that you talk about taking in your individual homes or individual lives that you think can help this problem?
Well, I think we do a little. We have to be careful that we don't turn around as a faith community and say to our members, you must do this, you must do this. Instead, what I find it's more powerful for us to engage in the conversations about why is this important to us. And when we discuss why is this important from a moral perspective, from a religious perspective, then we empower our members to go and make those individual choices themselves. So I think the key is not for us to turn around and say, everyone go and get an energy-saving refrigerator, but much more, let's all think about the sanctity of life. Let's think about what it means to live on Earth, what it means to understand Earth is created in any way. And then we empower people to make those choices.
Thank you very much for that perspective, Rabbi. You've grounded us a little bit, and that's really helpful. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I want to move on. Sean, I've been meaning to ask you this since the beginning of the show, because it's not very often that I get to talk to a meteorologist, and I'm kind of chomping at the bit here to ask you 1,000 questions. But El Nino this year, it seems like it did not do what we thought it was going to do. It at least here in New Mexico, I thought it meant that we were going to have a wetter winter than what actually happened. What happened here in New Mexico with El Nino this year?
The El Nino pattern that set up was, as measured, was one of the strongest on record. Not the strongest. I think it came in at number 2 or 3. And as such, based on past El Ninos, there's a very strong link when we have very strong El Ninos with a higher than normal precipitation in New Mexico. We had, going into the season, remembering back into November and December into January, in fact, I remember very clearly because we had relatives at our home around Christmas. And they were from out in the Baja, California, and they were sledding in snow all over the Rio Rancho. So we had plenty of snow up early, and then it just kind of flipped the switch. One of the things that happened was, it is hard to explain maybe, but the pattern didn't set up to its optimal best because of a lack of a temperature gradient out across the Pacific, the North Pacific.
Can I paraphrase that? Yes. That was kind of random?
Well, it had to do with that and with something else we call, they call it the blob, an area of warm water in the North Pacific as well, which decreased the temperature gradient between the North Pacific and the tropical areas, which then reduced the wind pattern that would have brought the storms our way. And that kicked into effect and changed the thing. So every El Nino, even the strongest ones, don't have the exact same complexion, let's say. So we were doing really well. We had here we had recently some more storms, which is kind of normal for this part of the time of the year. But, it was very odd that we had this very, very dry March and February as well. So we were doing really well up through January, and like a light switch went off.
So if climate change progresses a little more quickly, it's a long-range pattern is what I'm trying to get at. So
yes.
It's hard for us to take a really long view. I mean, when I look 50 years in the future, I look dead. So I want to know, what if it sped up a little bit and happened faster? What would be the kinds of things, hypothetically, that you'd be predicting for us to see in our weather that's different from now?
Well, some of it has been described already for the Southwest, and that is warmer overall, and we're already seeing that in lower temperatures. The minimum temperatures aren't as cold overall. The average temperatures are warmer. That's going to continue to happen, and that relates back to your question about the forests and the habitat and everything else. Volatility, because you have more energy remaining in the system, not escaping because of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere keeping a warm blanket over the planet, that energy has to be conserved somehow, and it can go into more volatility, stronger storms, a greater extremes one way or the other. Doesn't mean you're not going to ever have winter and so forth, but that's changing too, because for the Arctic snow, the polar cap in the Arctic is changing, and in the South Pole as well. And so those things also change directions of the winds that pass over these parts of the earth. So it's really hard to say exactly. Also, then the melting of the Greenland ice cap can change what they call the thermohaline circulation in the Atlantic Ocean, which changes then the Gulf Stream, which then changes wind patterns. So things could really get into territory that we really haven't seen in terms of, well, it happens this way every year. So we think of climate as that's normal. We use the word normal, but it's not really normal because climate on its own will change After all, we know there was an ice age, and now we're warmer, et cetera. But the rate of change is what we know is unprecedented, and that's why we call it human-induced climate change. And so the volatility is the main thing that we would expect to see, greater extremes one way or the other.
I want to go to the phones. The lines are full, so let's talk to some of these people. Katrina in Los Ranchos, welcome to the show. Good morning. Katrina, do we have you there?
Yes, thank you. I'm just going to launch into this because I have about three, maybe many more ways to save energy.
Well, Katrina, okay. Why don't you give me your number one top tip for saving energy?
Electrical energy.
Okay.
My average use per day for years has been average 2.5 kilowatt hours of electricity a day. And I do this by unplugging things that are not in use. Every cord that's plugged in is live and hot and drawing energy.
So that DVD player that we rarely use, the clock in the spare bedroom, that kind of stuff, go unplug it.
Even lights, yes. If you want a lamp, you know, plug it in when you want it and then unplug it. As many cords as you can unplug as possible, and especially those with a little LED.
A little glowing light.
Yeah.
Katrina, thank you so much for that tip. Everyone, go unplug stuff you're not using. Let's hear now from Mark in Albuquerque. Mark, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Yeah, hey, thanks for doing this. Really important topic. And this is great timing because the comment I want to make is that individual choices are just only going to take us so far. And, you know, we've really been blind to dealing with this problem on a policy level. And I think there's just so many things that we could be doing, and we need to be showing leadership here in the Southwest. For example, we could do something about our city lighting. We use so much electricity there. We could be switching to LEDs, using less lighting, or having a dark city even.
Yeah, I know that in our own homes, many of us are trying to do this, but I just installed under cabinet lighting in my kitchen, and I didn't buy the LEDs because they were so much more expensive. So I think, you know, we're going to have to make some tough decisions, aren't we?
Well, my point is that we need to be making policy decisions as a community, you know, anything and everything we can do to reduce the load on the energy that's coming out of the Four Corners area. I mean, that's such a burden, a pollution burden. We need to do every single thing we can.
So bring it
or
to your...
Or like with the art, how come there was no debate about a new rapid transit system that was going to be powered by some kind of alternative energy? We're just stuck in our mode of thinking, and we really need to change it.
Well, thank you, Mark, for encouraging us to break out of that mode. Let's take a call really quickly from Kelly in Albuquerque. Kelly, welcome to the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I agree with Mark. We need to get out of our mode of thinking. And one other way that a lot of people don't like to talk about is that the meat industry has a very devastating effect on climate change. In fact, it's been studied. The UN did a study that states that the livestock industry has more of a devastating effect than all of the cars, all of the buses, all of the airplanes put together, the whole entire transportation industry, than those industries. The meat industry is very devastating, just water-wise, methane gas coming from cows. So it is, like the rabbi spoke about, it is a moral responsibility that we either decrease our consumption or completely eliminate it.
Thank you for that, Kelly. Thank you for that. And that's a tough issue because so many folks in New Mexico raise cattle on their land. I know I have a lot of friends who depend on that. So we're going to have to find if growing fewer cattle is part of the solution, we're going to have to find other ways for so many people in New Mexico to make a living. Lee in Edgewood also wants to talk about cattle. Lee, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I think it's perfect timing, actually. I just like to point to the work of the Savory Institute, where they've actually, and like the last caller said, the way, it's not meat, it's the way we raise meat that's the problem. And we should just remember that 10,000 years ago, there was 40 large mammal species that have now gone extinct in North America, not to mention the 70 million buffalo. So why is it that the cows are so bad, but the mammoth, the sloths, the buffalo, the elk, why were they?
Oh, whoops, we lost him. Sorry about that. But, you know, that is a good point. Cattle have lived in this area for a really long time. You know, Rose, before a few minutes ago, we were talking about something, severe weather that Sean brought up, these cycles of, you know, higher extremes in the temperature, highs and lows, and wildfires. And I was thinking about those wildfires we saw near Los Alamos a few years ago, and then the tremendous flooding that came down from the Las Conchas fire and destroyed the Dixon apple orchards and all these other things. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what is it that, you know, you are seeing out there as a disaster recovery expert? What are you seeing that you think can be tied to some of these patterns?
What I've seen in my own lifetime is an increase in just about every different type of extreme element, if you could say. When I was there on Navajo Nation, we had ice, we had water, floods, fire, and earth, drought. I mean, all these different severe, as what was mentioned earlier, variable weather patterns and extreme weather. Wildfires are just becoming much more certain during times that they're not usually being prepared for, or the teams are not normally on call to do those types of wildfires.
Even if we are used, if we, you know, become used to a certain level of wildfire and flooding, and we tell ourselves this is part of a normal pattern, it's good, it refreshes the land, this is helpful, you know, this is how we're spreading our conifers, and this is how we're bringing new nutrients. What we're talking about is, you know, goes beyond the normal refreshing of the land.
Correct.
To actually doing damage. Didn't I hear that the Las Conchas fire was so hot that it burned all of those conifer seeds and they're just not going to come back? Laura, was that a story you did?
Yeah, we did a story earlier this year about the changing wildfire regimes, because wildfire is healthy in our southwestern forests. But what we've seen with the Las Conchas fire is they're burning so hot and so fast that they are destroying the ponderosa pines and the conifers, which typically are okay with fires.
But yeah, we look at them in the forest and you see, gosh, there's black all the way up the
right.
trunk of this thing. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, and the other thing that's happening is as the climate has gotten warmer, you see different types of trees coming back. The ponderosa pine, the conifers can't come back in these warmer temperatures. So you see a transition of the forest from these conifers to things like gamble oak.
Right. Rose, I want to come back to you for a minute. You know, we are starting to freak out. I'm starting to freak out a little bit. what should we be doing to prepare for this kind of severe weather in our homes today? You know, I'm going backpacking this weekend, and I have a little first aid kit in my backpack, and I spent like an hour the other day making sure I had enough blister band-aids in there and all sorts of stuff like that. And that got me thinking, like, should I be doing more planning like this for my house?
Right. Well, the main thing that there's a couple of things that we could be doing on individual and also on a larger perspective. From an individual perspective, yes, always have a preparedness kit in your car, in your vehicle, in your home, and make sure that you have, if there was something to happen, if there was something that could happen, be prepared to take care of your family. Because if you don't take care of your family, then especially when something happens, you become more of a victim and a statistic versus being an asset. during a disaster. So be prepared is one key thing.
Put together a bug out bag
yes.
of stuff you're going to need.
Yes. You can put them in a plastic container, a big plastic bin with your flashlight, your extra water, extra food that you don't have to worry that's going to non-perishable food items that you're going to lose when something happens. Another thing is that right now, what Mark had mentioned earlier, that policy decisions, even FEMA and DHS, Homeland Security, are looking at writing their policies. And what they're doing is they're reaching out to different communities. You know, how do we fix our NIMS, National Incident Management System? How do we revise policy for assessment, damage assessments? How do we revise policies for how a tribe declares a federal disaster? We have to be involved in that. If we're not involved in that, then somebody on the East Coast is going to be writing our policies for us. And they have no clue what it is to be in our communities.
How would we get involved in that? What do we do?
What they normally do is they'll send out mass announcements, or you can go to the FEMA website and just write in policy or rural community policy. But I'm always, always pushing those out to all of the people. And they're probably tired of all of my emails. I apologize to all those people that are on my emails. You see all of those. But I'm always pushing for people to be involved in that. Because at this moment, we need to show leadership. There has to be political will. If there's no political will, we're just going to be talking about the same thing next year and the year after that and the year after that until that last drip of water comes out of that faucet. Then we'll be wondering what the heck are we going to be doing for our larger perspective and our children.
Oof. All right, people, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the impact of climate change on Native and border communities with Juan Reynosa, an organizer who works on environmental justice issues with the Southwest Organizing Project. I want to know, we want to hear from you. So please do call us. Call us here at 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. That's 277-5866. Toll free 877-899-5866. You can email us at news@kunm.org. Post to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio, or tweet at KUNM News, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Mama's Minerals Earth Day Celebration with Fountains by Santiago, the Museum of Natural History, Big Brothers Big Sisters, Food, Fun, and More, Saturday, April 23rd, 10 till 3. Details and directions at mamasminerals.com.
Hank the truck had served so well, hauled everything, helped friends to move, went on adventures in the mountains. Basically, Hank had become a longtime friend. But when at last Hank couldn't run anymore, his owner decided in one last magnanimous gesture to make Hank's end have meaning. She donated Hank where his essence lives on in another friend, KUNM. You too can help two friends. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Noland. We're talking with environmental reporter Laura Paskus, meteorologist Sean Bennett, and disaster response and recovery expert Rose Whitehair. Joining us now is Juan Reynosa with the Southwest Organizing Project. He specializes in environmental justice. Welcome to the show, Juan.
Hello, and good morning.
Juan, what does environmental justice mean to you?
Oh, man, I was just talking about this at a Public Health Association conference in Las Cruces last weekend. You know, what I started off with was talking about a community's right to self-determination and to have a voice in the decision-making process around environmental issues that impact them. And I think a lot of the conversations that are happening earlier feed into that. I really appreciated the rabbi's efforts talking about how collectively we need to come together as communities to make these real big drastic changes that need to happen in regards to both addressing environmental justice issues and climate change. And environmental justice tends to center around how many of these impacts are focused on low-income communities of color. And as you all mentioned, you know, many of these border areas and indigenous areas are feeling the big brunt of these climate change impacts. You know, and you can also see that throughout the rest of the U.S. too. I would say that, you know, even Hurricane Katrina is a stark example of how climate change and environmental justice are really intertwined and how that can impact the community of color. Just seeing how things are happening in New Mexico, I really do agree with a lot of the arguments. It can't be case-by-case basis or individual level. Environmental justice tends to try to bring a collective together and bring together community members to resolve these issues. And I just think the essence of that is really what's needed in regards to climate change. And, you know, I think that was a common thread that many people have been emphasizing this morning. And I agree. Collectively, we have to make this change. And part of it is policy. And I think, you know, the work that I do, that's part of one of the toughest things that I encounter is policy in regards to trying to pass something that's pro quality of life, pro health, pro environment. As many of you all know on the show today, there's a lot of resistance to that policy wise. And, you know, I think part of it is because we're so inundated with oil and gas. But I also just feel like, you know, people are in their comfort zones. And until the real harsh impacts of climate change are right in your face, you know, people tend to not want to do anything. And so, you know, it's tough to get these conversations going at the policy level, but it's very important. And I think, you know, one of the ways to get leverage in order to do that is really uplifting the community voice who's impacted, you know. So, for instance, bringing those communities who have been impacted by environmental injustices and climate change and letting them vocalize why, you know, this type of policy is needed to help, you know, bridge the gap between a better quality of life for them and improving the climate of the entire state.
Juan, we're going to go to the phones right now, and let's hear from Sister Joan in Albuquerque, who wants to talk about faith communities. Welcome to the show, Sister Joan.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having the show. And I'm the Executive Director of New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light, and your show is really timely, especially in light of the signing tomorrow at the UN of the climate agreement, International Climate Agreement, that came out of COP21 in December. And I was at that meeting, and I think what is important for people to know, all of our individual actions and prayers are really important, and all of that's rooted in faith traditions, of all the religious traditions. But the other element that's really important is not to give up and to engage in the ethical, moral imperatives needed in policy action. And when I was at the COP, one of the organizers of the conference, UN conference in Paris, said he was so grateful for the faith communities because worldwide, he said, this is the first time the ethical moral imperative for climate change was on the table with the delegates and was front and center. And it was one of a number of reasons why that agreement, that accord, passed, even though there was disagreement with certain things on it. It was that, it was what people have already been talking about on the show, the effort of civil society to organize in communities, and it was also because we are at a crisis moment. So it's really, really important for us to act because it's affecting us here in New Mexico and our brothers and sisters around the world, and I think that was really held up last year with Laudato Si on Care of Our Common Home, the encyclical on economics and climate change.
Sister Joan, I was just going to ask you about the Pope.
Yes. So I think he says many things in that encyclical, and it really has captured people's imagination, attention, and their actions. And one of the things he said is we are not faced with two concerns, one social and one environmental, but it's all one piece, and we need to be acting in that way. And there's many things people can do. I just have been gathering, about 100 faith leader signatures on comments, a letter to the Bureau of Land Management on a methane rule that they'll be coming out with, and the last day for comments is tomorrow, which is significant. It's Earth Day, and it's also the signing of the COP agreement. But there are many things that we can do to get
Sister
engaged.
Sister Joan, I hate to interrupt you, but we have only a few minutes left on the show, and we have a couple more issues to get you. Thank you for calling in and talking about the faith community and the impact of the Pope and his leadership on this, and the work that you and your group are doing here in New Mexico. We really appreciate
it. Thank you so much, and bless.
So, Juan, I wanted to ask you, we had a Twitter comment from Katie who was wondering, you know, how long we're going to have fresh water and water in our ditches. I know driving out of my house this morning, I drove past the ditch and saw it was full of water and thought, oh, isn't that wonderful? But, you know, the acequias are so much a part of New Mexico's rural tradition. How are you seeing impacts of drought on communities' ability to pursue traditional farming?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, obviously that's a big reason why we're doing the Santa Lina fight is because people who have been farming for generations on this land are having to deal with threats to our water resources and our way of life that we've been, you know, living off of for generations. And to us at SWAP, that's very serious because we definitely feel that cultural preservation is a key part of the fight for environmental justice. And so, you know, Chicano or Native communities who've been farming for lifetimes aren't able to do that anymore. That definitely impacts their way of life. And I also say, you know, having conversations with my father who lives in Texas, you know, it's interesting to hear him talking about how, you know, even ranchers are starting to jump into the mix around water because, you know, they're having to fight over it with the people who are doing fracking over there, you know, which is a very interesting case, especially for Texas. But I think that's something that we've been focusing on in regards to trying to push for smaller local farms, because I think that, you know, as some other people mentioned, we have to go on a smaller scale, you know, in regards to the big CAFOs with cows. I think it's the same deal. The reason these are so impactful is because of the large use of resources or the large presence of animals. And so in regards to our water resources, obviously we need some better preservation methods, but I also think in regards to the policy realm, community members need to be on the forefront of making the decisions about our water. You know, and there, when there's big disagreements between community members who run acequias around the availability of water and entities like the Albuquerque Water Utility Authority, you know, that's a big conversation that we need to continue, because if there's a differing thoughts on how much water we have, then we really need to figure that out before we can start doling out huge amounts of water, because
yeah, if the,
that impacts our communities.
If the water authority isn't talking about fluoride, nobody ever goes to those meetings. So
right.
You should
exactly.
Probably go when you're not all cranky about whether they're going to add or reduce fluoride.
Right.
Laura, talk to us for a couple of minutes here about some of the recent work you've been doing at New Mexico In Depth for this project and some of the stories you've been most excited about.
So I'm glad that Sister Joan called in. One of the stories that was really great to work on was about communities of faith and how they're responding to issues surrounding climate change and social justice. And we did that story in cooperation with the Santa Fe Reporter. And that was, you know, there's a lot of excitement around the Pope talking about this stuff. You know, for me, a lapsed Catholic, I was like, wow, I kind of like this Pope guy. Some of the other stories that I think were, you know, sort of eye-opening for me had to do with wildfire management and forests and kind of what's happening to our forests and how the agencies have to think about management.
I think you told me earlier that we are spending a lot more money on wildfire management than we used to.
Right. In the 1980s and 1990s, it was like 13%, fighting wildfires was like 13% of the Forest Service budget. Now it's more than half their budget, which means they're not able to do a lot of the other things that they need to be doing. I also covered the Martinez administration's energy plan, which was released last year, and she talked about in the State of the State address, so kind of drilling down into that energy plan and what that means for New Mexico.
Was there climate change adaptation in that plan?
No, there is the phrase climate change is never used in that plan. Carbon constrained future or something like that is mentioned a few times. And there is, you know, discussion around alternative energies and the use of nuclear energy. But the, you know, everybody has brought up these policy issues. And I think one of the things about this project that's been really interesting for me is I talked to a lot of different people, from scientists at Los Alamos. Later today, I'm going to be talking with some high school students. Everybody has all these ideas and questions about climate change. And every time I try to call up a state agency, whether it's the governor's office this week or the New Mexico Environment Department, I can't get anybody at the state to talk to me about climate change, which I think is really unfortunate.
Well, Sean, I want to go to you and ask you, in terms of concrete things that our listeners can do to kind of prepare for some of these severe weather incidents, whether it's, you know, hail at a weird time of year or a little bit more water or colder temperatures. I know that my neighbors were able to put in their garden weeks ago because the forecast told them it wasn't going to freeze. And I was like, really? This seems really early to me. But in fact, it hasn't. Do you have any concrete steps that listeners should take to get in gear?
Well, I would like to reflect what Rose said about being prepared first when it comes to severe weather. The time to be prepared is before it happens. And the key factor I'd like to say is information is what really saves lives. The Weather Service puts out the information in terms of its alerts, its bulletins, advisories, watches, and warnings. And you can hear all of those on a weather radio, or you can tune in at the on the website and get information there. We're on Twitter and Facebook and so on. So
I follow you on Twitter, and you can find a whole lot of weather conversation at hashtag NMWX.
Yes.
NM
right.
Weather. You can find you guys on Twitter, and and then I follow all your links to your cool pictures and your weather statements, because I'm a little bit of a nerd. So.
Right. So you want to get the information. The information is what's going to save lives, and having that information before. And then having your plan and having you ready to activate whatever that plan. And to me, it's kind of similar to if you have, you should have a plan on how to get out of your house if the house is on fire and you're prepared in your house. Most of us have a smoke alarm. So in the same way, you'd have a weather radio, be prepared to act. The weather radio, by the way, now our cell phones all get the alerts and so on.
Right.
So. You have to get the information, but you have to know what to do. And it's been echoed here. Most people don't take an action until they're scared, and then they do something.
And then we're not thinking
very clearly.
Spend
a little time and look at it and be prepared, and then you'll be better off.
Thank you. Rose, you know, what can we learn from looking at Native communities' resilience in the face of severe weather and crises?
Sure. There's a story that I like to tell, and I'm going to try and tell it as quickly as I can. But during the 2010 snowfall, Operation Snowfall, we had a number of National Guard that came in to help us, and we also had help from the state in several levels, including FEMA. It was a federally declared disaster. And at that time, I'd like to pick the picture of this hogan out on the in the mountains, and there were 5-foot snowdrifts. In some areas, I mean, huge snowdrifts, and Black Hawk helicopters were coming in and dropping hay, and they were also dropping MREs and different types of non-perishable food items. And they landed in front of this. They landed their helicopter in this community and in front of this hogan. And this little grandma came out, and she squinted to see what was going on, and she waved them over and told them, come in, eat. And she used her little wood stove and made them nanascare tortillas and fried them up some potatoes and served them coffee.
She was like, thanks for those MREs. Let me give you some real food.
Yes, you guys must be starving.
Rose, yeah, if that's what you're going to eat, you
must
be in trouble.
That's resiliency.
Rose, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. Laura Paskus, thank you for sharing your stories. We have links on the website to some of your stories. Please go click on those, read them, and go to New Mexico In Depth and look at the Climate Project. And follow the National Weather Service in Albuquerque on Twitter. Sean Bennett, thank you so much for coming in and being with us today. Go to the website if you missed any of the show today and check out the audio. It'll be up there soon. And if you have comments about the show, email them to collinshow@kunm.org. Find us on Facebook at KUNM Radio, or follow the newsroom on Twitter at KUNM News. Thanks to Jefferson White, our engineer, Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Anna Landy assisted with production, and Ed Williams was our producer today. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland.